Hey, football fans, it's Patrick Peterson, former three-time All-Pro NFL cornerback, and now the new host of First and Pod, the podcast that breaks down every game, every week, with new episodes dropping every Monday and Friday mornings. Plus, I'll be highlighting key matchups for DBs around the league on Patrick's Corner. Be sure to subscribe to First and Pod on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This hour of the Chris and Amy Show is brought to you by Budget Buddy, helping you save big on coffee so you can buy more coffee.
It's the Chris and Amy Show. Check it out.
St. Louis, Mound City, we are going to have a great day today.
Now, Amy Marks Corps, Chris Ronji on KMOX.
Let's take it from the top.
What's up, friends? Hope you're doing great. It is the Chris and Amy Show. Like you heard her say, Amy Marks Corps, Chris Ronji, good morning. We will be with you for the next 3 hours, and we hope that you will stick with us. We got a phone number, 314-436-7900. If you are listening to us on 1120 AM, great option. You can listen to it in so many different places because it stretches far and wide. But you can also give us a try on 98.7 FM. And if that doesn't work, get that free Odyssey app. Download it and take us with you wherever you go. Even if you're in Bermuda, you can listen to us right from your phone.
Time now for the top of the order. The top three stories everybody will be talking about.
Well over 100,000 people have been evacuated from various parts of Los Angeles. At least five dead in what has become the most destructive fire in L.A.
And going on right now is the funeral for Jimmy Carter in Washington, D.C. Former presidents like Bill Clinton, George Bush, Barack Obama, President-elect Donald Trump all gathered to honor former President Jimmy Carter.
Saw former President Trump, President-elect Trump, and former President Obama sharing a laugh together, there before the funeral started.
And our friend of the show, Stuart Eisenstadt, who joined us to talk about Jimmy Carter, is giving a eulogy right now.
Also, sorry, but another round of snow is headed our way starting tonight. May not be as bad as last time, but it is still coming. And the Blues will play the Ducks tonight, so there is a lot going on. Amy, Chris, here with you today. And again, we are very happy that you're hanging out with us. So I'm perfectly fine with the snow. I have no problem with it.
Love it.
I would like more pre-Christmas snow, as I've said, but I can handle the post-Christmas snow, I guess. It's nice to see. I wish the roads were a little better in certain areas, which we're going to talk about today. But these wildfires continue, and we will be talking to an AccuWeather meteorologist a little bit later in the show just to get an idea of exactly what to expect tonight with our weather here and to give us more of an idea of how and why the LA wildfires are so bad. And there are multiple wildfires. It started with three of them. Now we're all the way up to six. So they are in various different places.
Yeah.
I think the numbers are closer to about 150,000 people who have been asked to evacuate. We've got people here who have family who have had to evacuate. Mm-hmm. I've had friends that I've tried to get a hold of. I think they're okay, but I have not heard back from them. Certainly they are busy and dealing with a lot. And I think many of us know somebody at this point in Los Angeles who has had to go somewhere else because of what's happening. And a lot of people I know for a fact are very afraid of what's going to happen.
Yeah, the images, to be honest, they look apocalyptic. I heard today on Total Information AM, Megan Lynch was talking to someone who had been evacuated or had evacuated and said it was like driving through hell. And honest to goodness, that's what we said last night, flipping around Fox, CNN, you know, all the different coverage from the national news, cable news stations. And it does look like hell. There's no other way to describe it. It just looks apocalyptic. The devastation, thousands of buildings destroyed. I think for me, I said, I think I'm a coward or something. But when they showed people evacuating, and the fires move so quickly, you know, overnight it went from like 200 acres to 16,000 acres. So we're talking the fires with 100-mile-an-hour winds, 60-mile-an-hour winds, they move so quickly that it is hard to gather and evacuate in time. And they showed people who were evacuating, And the traffic was so bad that they were sitting there for 3 and 4 hours. The fire department started knocking on their windows and said, get out and run.
Yeah.
And there's fire on both sides and you're running. And I'm thinking, I might die of a heart attack in that moment because you're surrounded by flames.
And smoke.
And so the fact that people, and I mean, these are families. They're carrying a dog. They've got their suitcases. They've abandoned their cars. And I don't know if you saw this, Ranj, because of the abandoned cars blocking the way for the fire trucks.
The bulldozers?
Bulldozers scooping up vehicles and just pushing them out of the way.
Yeah, I saw that on Sunset Boulevard.
Oh, my gosh.
They're pushing cars out of the way so that emergency vehicles or whoever else can get through. That is absolutely terrifying that it's ended up like that. And, you know, you see interviews happen with people and, you know, good on these reporters. I know it's their job. But to go to these places and talk to people, show us images, give us an idea of what's happening. But to watch them interview people, whether it's CNN or any of the other networks, and have folks who are in their places, in their homes still, and are just like not sure if they should go.
Yeah.
Because there was one guy they interviewed who said, I just put everything I have into this house, into renovating this house, into making it what it is. And I don't know if I should leave, you know, not like he can do anything about it. But, you know, there's that. Should I go? Should I not go? If I go, am I going to regret leaving because nothing happened? And now I got to make my way back. But I guess always err on the side of being as cautious as possible and get out.
I mean, just
but I understand, Amy, I totally get why people are reluctant to leave.
Oh, yeah. It has to be, in some ways, a different natural disaster. But think of the people in Florida who are like, I'm going to ride this out.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to be okay. Now, granted, you're not going to ride out the flames. You can't ride out the flames. But that reluctance to
leave.
You're
just hoping they don't make it to you.
So this is how far or how fast the fire moves. There was, and I forgot her name, which I hate because she was with CNN. She was a reporter. She was standing there among the flames. And right as they ended their live shot, she said the wind shifted, something changed. And she said, I think, because they left like some type of recording going. And she's like, I think we might be stuck here. So they got in their car and they were blocked in by flames on every side. They found a fire truck and said, how do we get out of here? And the firefighter shrugged his shoulders and said, maybe try south. And I'm like, oh my gosh. So she said, they turned south. They found a fire truck that was going south. And she goes, we like got on his tail and we followed him. At one point, there was a huge explosion. The fire truck stopped. They stopped. And she thought, I'm going to die. Like, this is how, like, we're not going to get out. And they were able to sneak out somehow. But she said, we were surrounded on all sides by flames and thought that was it. Thought it was over.
Yeah. As I mentioned, or you mentioned, the death toll is 5 right now. I think that certainly is going to rise, hopefully not that much more. It's terrifying, and putting yourself in that position is, I think I would like to think that I would know how to handle it and I would do the right thing, but I can see having some reluctance that it's probably not going to be that bad. The flames aren't going to get to where I am. I'll be okay.
That's where you're weird, because you are such a worrier. But I could see you waiting longer than most people.
No, I'm a worrier about germs.
Yes, germs.
That's it.
And big boats.
Well, it's called megalophobia.
Yes.
I have a thing called megalophobia. I'm afraid of big things.
You're a funny guy, because I could see me like totally like getting out of there. Like, I'm like, well, I live in Utah. I better leave. You know, like, and then I would be calling Ron. And you're like, you know, I think it's going to be okay.
I live in a building where the fire alarm shorts sometimes. And it goes off, and I just, it's happened so frequently that I just never leave every time the fire alarm goes off.
Well,
I just, it's fine.
Yeah, that is something like the tornado alarms. They go off all the time. I will say this. The interviews were devastating. The images were, I actually at one point had to turn them off, because I think you're just absorbing all of this destruction and suffering and pain, and it makes you physically ill. And I'm like, I gotta turn this off for a bit. But Anderson Cooper did do an interview. And you know how sometimes when an interview doesn't go quite the way you think it's going to go? So Anderson Cooper was standing on a street with the house burning behind him, right? He's on the scene. And he interviews two young men who He had evacuated their home. So they're in a hotel room. They're safe. And I guess they were like tech bros or just high or both. I'm not sure. But he's like, you know, you guys evacuated. And he talks to the one guy who said, and you came back to help your friend, to rescue your friend. He's like, yeah. He's like, I don't even know him that well, honestly. I just thought, you know, deep down, I think he's a pretty good guy. And I like who he is. I like his spirit. I think he's a good guy. We just met. But I thought, you know, it might be the right thing to do because he seemed like such a great guy. And Anderson's like, okay, we get it. What was the evacuation like? And the guy that was rescued, his name was Orly. Orly goes, yeah, man, I walked outside. It was like a snowstorm, except the snow hurts your face. That junk is bunk, man. That junk is bunk. And Anderson Cooper was like, thank you very much.
Be safe out there.
Be safe.
That's fantastic.
They seemed totally unperturbed. And the guy spent like 45 seconds, instead of explaining the evacuation, explaining that even though he just met him, he had a really nice soul. And he liked who he was.
And so, which means
they were high out of their minds.
Or if he thought that guy sucked, he'd be like, I'm not going back for
him.
Right,
right. But the junk is bunk. Just deal with it. And Anderson's like, okay, thank you. I will say it was a little moment of levity, but the incredulity on Anderson Cooper's face, because he couldn't see them. He's on the street. He's doing this interview purely by audio. And I think he thought, am I being punked right now? This can't be who I'm supposed to be talking to.
Well, you find some levity, I guess, in what is a really awful situation. And by the way, when we come back on the other side, there's a facet of this tragedy that is happening in Los Angeles that I find to be, personally, it bothers me quite a bit. And it's completely unnecessary, at least from my perspective. I know Amy has some thoughts as well. We'll talk about that when we come back. It is Amy Markscores and Chris Ranji. Don't forget that you can drop us a voice message on the Odyssey app whenever you want. It's the Chris and Amy Show.
One can't even respond to it. I mean, it's people are literally fleeing. People have lost their lives. Kids lost their schools. Families completely torn asunder. Churches burned down. This guy wanted to politicize it. I have a lot of thoughts, and I know what I want to say. I won't. I stood next to a president of the United States of America today, and I was proud to be with Joe Biden, and he had the backs of every single person in this community. He didn't play politics, didn't try to divide any of us.
That's California Governor Gavin Newsom yesterday on CNN, and he was referring to President-elect Donald Trump, who, along with many other people, more on the right. There has been some criticism on the left, but there's been quite a bit of it on the right about this wildfire or these wildfires and how out of control they have gotten and leadership in California, whether it is Newsom, the governor, or the Los Angeles mayor, Karen Bass, or even the fire chief, the leader of the fire department in the county being criticized for what is happening now. And I just listening to it, and I watched a little bit of CNN last night, and they've got Scott Jennings, who is one of the conservative voices that they use, and he's on multiple shows throughout the day. And he was blaming DEI for the situation that is happening in California. When any meteorologist you talk to, anybody who's an expert on what is happening, and I'm one of those people that still listens to experts. I still listen to people who know what they're talking about because they study these topics. They study weather. They study what is happening. They're telling us that the air is unusually dry there while these Santa Ana winds are coming in. And it is a recipe for absolute disaster, and it is playing out. To me, if we were looking at this the right way, We're trying to figure out how we can, mitigate some of the climate issues we're dealing with so that these disasters don't happen. Some of the real root causes of what is going on. While climate change is not making these fires, it is making the fires worse. So I feel like we could address that instead of blaming diversity programs for where the fire department is right now. Look, I think that you can, on substantive issues, you can make critiques of policy and say, I don't really like this one. I'm not sure it actually helps the department. I don't know if this is good for government. I don't know if this is good for the citizenry, whatever. But I don't feel like that's what any of this is. To me, it feels like an opportunity to blame people from the opposite political party they don't like, who are in charge currently, to blame them for a disaster and say this is all their fault, when a lot of this probably would have happened anyway, regardless of who's in charge, because of the current environment in California.
Yeah, I mean, right. I get that some of the hyper political messaging where you're saying, where you just go straight to, well, it's DEI without explaining the point. What it does do is it delegitimizes, or at least causes people to disregard credible, fair, and objective critiques. And what I mean by that is, in some ways, it's political because, as we say, elections have consequences. And Gavin Newsom and the mayor of Los Angeles have their political priorities. That's what makes you a Democrat or a Republican, is you have certain priorities. And they are very outspoken about DEI, which, okay, that's their priority. It's not that DEI caused the fire. I think what people are saying is, listen, we know the fires are going to happen anyway, because everyone is saying that these fires are going to be more frequent. They're going to be more severe. So what we need to do is prepare for them, because, yes, this fire would have happened no matter who's governor, no matter who's mayor, no matter who's president. The fire would have happened most likely because wildfires are going to happen. What you then have is local government and perhaps what people see as misplaced priorities. There's a letter, and I'm looking at the actual letter itself, from the L.A. fire chief, Kristen Crawley, who warned Mayor Karen Bass of Los Angeles that the nearly $18 million that the mayor cut from the department, quote, severely limited the department's capacity to prepare for, train for, and respond to large-scale emergencies, including wildfires. So I've been watching the coverage, and a lot of the firefighters and the people have said, well, with the manpower we have, we're doing okay. We're doing the best we can. But I mean, this is an official letter from the fire department saying, hey, we know you gave money to this library and we know you gave money over here, but you cut almost $18 million from a fire department when you're telling everyone these fires are going to happen because of climate change. And I also know, like, you know, again, I'm not an expert on, you know, the water and the reservoirs, but we know that in the largest dam removal project in the country, I think in the world, in order to like return some, you know, indigenous lands and help with the survival of a certain fish species, that a lot of the reservoirs were emptied. The dams were knocked down because of this environmental push by Gavin Newsom. Now, what they've done to go day to day is they've implemented heavier water regulation, which has allowed each person to be more efficient with water usage. Now, you can be fined $10,000 if you water your lawn.
Well, California's always done that with water usage. They've always been on top of it.
And what I'm saying is that they've increased it, because this is, I actually have the numbers. It's super boring. I couldn't get through the whole paper of the water usage and how they were able to become more efficient. And that was commendable. But what happened is it didn't allow them the resources to have what they needed in case of an emergency.
So that's not what I have also seen and read a lot about the way the water is set up there. And because of the terrain, they are not where the Palisades are, for example, is not plugged into their water grid. They call it a water grid, that they have their own reservoirs, which were full, but they're not built to fight this. They're not built to fight this scale of fire. So we can just blame people all we want, and it seems to me like it's misdirected, and it's easier to say, see, it's these Democrats who are in charge, and this is why these fires are happening, than really truly tackle the root of the problem. Now, this is reporting from Politico. They say that $17 or $18 billion or million dollar budget that was that the number was decreased. They say that's not true, that the city was in the process, and this is a direct quote, mm-hmm. of negotiating a new contract with the fire department at the time the budget was being crafted. So additional funding for the department was set aside in a separate fund until that deal was finalized in November. In fact, the city's fire budget increased more than $50 million year over year compared to last budget cycle. So I don't really know where the discrepancy is. I don't know that this is about money or that it is about manpower. I think some natural disasters are just going to be too damn big to contain.
They can, and I guess...
Again, and the other part is, we talked about this yesterday, they don't have any air support. They couldn't get the planes in the sky to drop the solution,
understand.
which it has to be fought on the ground and from the air, and they have been unable to do it for most of the last 48 hours because of the wind conditions.
Yeah, no, it's going to be a disaster no matter what. The letter I have from the Los Angeles Fire Chief, Kristen Crowley, the one who's actually faced some criticism, this letter is December 4th, saying we don't have the money, we don't have what we need. So if that was resolved in November, not sure why she wrote the letter on December 4th. But I will say, when there's a disaster like this and people are suffering and there is loss and pain and damages, you really get frustrated with a message. For instance, if you're a family member whose family got shot or, like, you know, suffered from a homicide, and the mayor's at the Washington Post saying, well, crime is down, you're going to be upset, right? Or if the potholes aren't being filled, and then you're trying to get somewhere because of an emergency and the potholes aren't filled, you're going to say this was a failure in leadership. I think that's what it comes down to, is when people have civic concerns, local concerns that they feel aren't being addressed, and then a disaster happens and they feel that those unaddressed civic issues have exacerbated the situation, I think it builds up a lot of frustration.
That's fair, but I also think some of this is just hyperbole and opportunism. That's what I think this is. And I think the evidence of this is, well, just think about this the next time there's a school shooting and you have somebody on the right who says this is not the time to politicize a tragedy. Just remember that. And I hope they stick with that. I would hope they would stick with that now, but apparently they are willing to politicize a tragedy when they think it is good for them. When we come back, we're going to talk to Major Garrett. It is our weekly visit with him. He is he's going to be on coverage, I think, after the funeral of former President Jimmy Carter, which is still ongoing right now. But he's going to take a moment to visit with us when we come back on KMOX. About this time every week, we talk to our guy, Chief Washington Correspondent for CBS News, the author of The Big Truth, Upholding Democracy in the Age of the Big Lie, a couple of podcasts, The Agent of Betrayal and The Takeout, and Major Garrett is with us on KMOX. Good morning, Major.
Good morning. How is everyone?
We are doing okay. Today is the, it is ongoing right now. In fact, President mm-hmm. Biden has just stepped to the lectern to deliver a eulogy for former President Carter on what is a solemn day in the country. We've got mm-hmm. a lot going on. In fact, we're going to get to, but I know you're on coverage of this today. What has the day been like so far in Washington?
It's a really important day. Anytime we begin the process as a nation of memorializing a president, it's a moment to reflect on what was and what can be in America, because the presidency flows through everything about us. And the reappraisals of the Carter presidency are front and center and have been for the better part of a week and a half. There's been tremendous emphasis, understandably, on his post-presidency. But during some of the remarks today from grandson Jason, from his top domestic advisor, Stuart Eisenstadt, and others, there's been a kind of assessment that, though politically, and it's really important because politics flows through the presidency as much as anything else, Jimmy Carter's was almost a continuously unpopular presidency. Twice in his presidency, he had an approval rating of 26%, 1978 and again in 1980. So in the presidency himself, he was not viewed as productive or popular by the vast majority of our country. Nevertheless, many of his accomplishments, underappreciated or overlooked entirely at the time, live with us today. And that's always something that happens when we lay a president to rest and we go through this long 2-week process, typically to evaluate things that we missed at the time, things that we're reappraising, things that have had a chance to live in terms of a legacy. And the Carter presidency is now front and center as we do that kind of inspection and reflection.
Major, yesterday, Trump held a closed-door meeting with Senate Republicans where I believe he proposed a big, beautiful bill, as he as he called it. It's a pretty.
What else would it be?
It's a big, beautiful bill.
Small and ugly? I don't think so.
And there's a lot in it. I mean, it could be everything from his no tax on tips to raising or eliminating the debt limit. What do we know about what's in there and the viability of this bill to keep moving forward?
So for the audience's benefit, you're going to hear a lot. And if you've paid any attention to the Trump transition, you've already heard a lot. One bill or two bills. Let me try to simplify this. Currently, President-elect Trump, soon to be President Trump, will be in favor of whatever passes by whatever means necessary. And the Senate filibuster, the 60-vote requirement, which blocks a lot of legislation, meaning you have to have a bipartisan consensus, doesn't apply to the biggest component parts of this agenda. Why? Because there is a particular means by which you can get things through the Senate through something called reconciliation. Then you only need 50 votes. Lots of things recently have passed by this mechanism, Democratic and Republican presidents. You can do this once or twice in any given budget year. So the question is, do you do all this in one bill or do you do it in two bills? That's this one or two bill question. There's a tremendous effort to make progress immediately upon Inauguration Day, soon after, on border security issues. If you put those in a reconciliation bill, you can do that within 2 or 3 weeks. That's the two bill strategy. You do border first, put money, resources, on that question, early victory, quick victory lap, emphasizing this issue that was, if not front and center, very important to the Trump campaign in 2024. Or the one bill strategy is you wait on the border stuff and you tuck it in with raising the debt ceiling, with extending the Trump tax cuts, possibly adding other tax cuts, possibly adding tariffs into one huge bill that has many, many, many dimensions to it. If you do that, you probably can't do that legislatively until sometime in April. And why do I say April? Well, it takes a long time to write a bill of this complexity. Also, early April is when the special elections for the House members that Trump has plucked out of the House Republican Conference and put into his cabinet will be held. Adding those Republican seats in the House of Representatives will give Mike Johnson, the Speaker, a little more breathing room. And as we learned from the hair's breadth election of Speaker Johnson, he needs every vote he can get because one defection can put things into jeopardy. Having two or three more House Republicans added after the special elections in early April would give the big bill strategy more running room in the House. The question is, can Trump wait until April to put a big victory on the board? These are the kind of things that are being jostled back and forth. He will do whatever he needs to do and agree to whatever strategy gets the most done the quickest, and that's not clear yet.
Elon Musk and his Department of Government Efficiency organization, where he pledged to cut $2 trillion from the deficit, which is a pretty lofty number. He's sort of walking that back now. I think reality's hitting him in the face a bit. So what's going to be the reality of this department?
Look, first of all, it's not a department. It's not even an office. It's not even a laptop, okay? It's nothing. It's an entity that could be created, invested with some sort of legitimacy once President Trump takes office. But we don't know. It's not going to be an appendage of the White House. At least they've said so far. So it might just be ideas that Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy send to the president informally and that he sends to Congress. Now, there's a way you could legislatively create a Department of Government Efficiency and say you're not going to have a big office, but here's what we're going to do. If you recommend it to Congress, we promise you no amendments and a straight up or down vote on whatever you recommend. Why do I point out that particular approach? Well, a long time ago, many, many years ago, when we were deciding to close military bases in this country because we no longer needed them after the end of the Cold War, they created something called the Base Realignment and Closure Commission. And the only way that that proposal on a base closure could come before Congress was a strict up or down vote, no amendments. Why did they do that? Because if you amend it, then everyone gets a chance to pick it apart. And the commission had an idea, no, we don't need this base. Here's the reason why. Vote yes or no to keep it open or keep it closed. That's the only question. That's the only option. When you do it that way, things that are resistant to political closure get closed. So you could do that. You could invest this DOGE process with a formula in Congress where it's a straight up or down vote. Absent that, nothing is going to happen. So Congress needs to be a part of this conversation just procedurally to make anything happen. The second reality is most of the spending in the federal government is not waste, fraud, and abuse. It just isn't. It's Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. Are there things in there that can be tightened? Yes. But let's just take Medicare for a quick example. You want to tighten Medicare? You know how you do that? Well, you lower reimbursements for doctors. Okay. That means doctors get paid less for visits or procedures. All right. That's a signal to doctors. They don't have to participate in Medicare. If they don't like the reimbursement rates, they get out. What does that create? That creates shortages of available care, which creates what? A pretty rapid, instantaneous political problem. There are ways to iron this out, but it takes a long time to iron out, and it's not instantaneous. One last quick statistic. I'm going to ask you a question. When you think of the federal workforce, can you think of the largest allotted federal workforce for any given agency? Take a stab at it.
Department of Defense?
Nope. Veterans Affairs. Veterans Affairs, 21% of the civilian workforce. Veterans Affairs, okay? Let me ask you another question. What percentage of the federal workforce, full-time employees, FTEs, do you believe resides in the greater Washington, D.C. area? Out of 100%, what percentage do you believe resides in the greater Washington, D.C. area?
5.
I feel like it's going to be low.
Yeah.
It's 20%.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not nothing. It's not nothing. But it's 20%. The other 80% are distributed around the country.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So this idea that we've got to tackle and bring to heel this grotesque Washington-based bureaucracy statistically isn't representative. Matter of fact, Bill Clinton, when he was president, and Al Gore, when they reinvented government, if you remember that, moved a lot of the federal workforce to contractors who are not even full-time federal government employees. They work as contractors. Most of those contractors do not reside in Washington, D.C. They're dispersed all over the country. And so these are some of the fundamentals that make numbers like $1 trillion or $2 trillion sound great, but exceedingly difficult to accomplish.
Yeah, Major, as you mentioned, like talking about cutting excess spending, of course. I mean, that sounds great. We want to cut excess spending.
We do, sure. Yeah, and it's doable. I'm not saying it's not doable. I'm just saying it's much harder to do than people believe or is communicated to them on the X platform or Facebook or anywhere else.
Right. And also the target is often the wrong one. You mentioned the federal workforce. Brookings Institute said that according to their polls, most Americans believe foreign aid is about 25% of the federal budget. They say it should be 10% of the budget. They're like, we need to get it down to 10%. In reality, it is less than 1% of the budget.
Correct.
Ukraine is not bankrupting us.
No. Now, there's a legitimate question about munitions and things that we're producing and sending and how we can be have our stockpiles ready. That's a legitimate question, but guess what you have to do? You have to spend more to do that. All I'm saying is everyone is in favor of government efficiency. Achieving government efficiency is much harder in practice than it is in reality. And one last thing, as we are thinking about President Carter, during his 4 years, did four things, really, that we live with now, on making government more efficient that we don't really associate with President Carter. He deregulated the airlines. The reason Southwest Airlines exists and any low-cost carrier that's ever come since the 70s is because Carter deregulated the airlines. He also deregulated trucking and rails. That propelled FedEx monstrously into its future and then created rivals like DHL and UPS. The modern shipping world, Amazon and everything else, is a direct reflection of that decision. He also began the process of deregulating telecommunications, creating the entire cable industry, which led to streaming and everything else. Those things were ways to make government more efficient, to get government out of the way of the private economy and allow things to prosper. Reagan didn't do that, though most people think Reagan did that. Jimmy Carter actually did that. So those are ways government can get involved. Mm-hmm. They're not so much dollars and cents, but unleashing things. Carter was ahead of his time in all three.
Tell us who's on the podcast this week, Major.
So related to that, we recorded this December of last year, not 2024, December of 2023. Jonathan Alter wrote a great biography. I highly recommend it. If you have any interest in Jimmy Carter at all, and I'm not suggesting everyone does or even a large percentage of your audience does, but if you are, the book, His Very Best, Jimmy Carter, A Life by Jonathan Alter, is a tremendous biography. It is critical in places, laudatory in others, comprehensive in every way. We recorded this more than a year ago because we thought, as many people reasonably did, that Jimmy Carter's passing was, you know, it could be any week now. Well, he went to live on 13 more months after we recorded this. But Jonathan Alter is our guest, and I've re-listened to the interview. It holds up really well. It's a great show.
Major Garrett, we appreciate you as always. And if you are still a Chargers fan, which I'm not sure, good luck to you.
I am not.
Oh, you're off?
I am not.
Okay. All right. So
I want them to lose and lose as rapidly and in most humiliating fashion possible.
Go Houston Texans.
Wow.
There you go.
Yes, I have no NFL team anymore because my NFL team left the hometown I grew up in. So it's all Missouri Tigers 24/7.
Well, I got a team for you if you'd like to adopt one, and you can be miserable with me.
And that team is?
The Bears.
He's a Chicago Bears fan, Major.
Would you like to join
Chicago
me?
Chicago Bears.
No, you know, look, seriously, because all my friends have asked me about this when the Chargers left San Diego. Well, what team are you going to adopt? I'm like, I was a Charger fan for 55 years. I'm not going to adopt any other team because... Hello.
Well,
all those years, and I rooted against all those other teams.
You could pick a team that sucks mine, so you won't be bandwagoning.
No. My Sundays are much less complicated.
Okay, great.
Major, I just have to say, this is how insane Ronj gets his Twitter feed when the Bears lose. Who did you tweet? The NBC.
Oh, Andrea Mitchell?
He tweeted at Andrea Mitchell when the Bears lost. Like, what's she going to do?
She said something about how great the Washington Commanders played at the end of the game. I was like, yeah, Andrea, it's not because the Bears suck. I don't think she saw it.
Norm O'Donnell's next? I don't know.
I do think Caleb Williams is going to work out, and that's going to be a great draft pick, and I do think the Bears' future is brighter than it is right now, but that's not saying much.
No, it does to me. Thank you, Major.
All right. Thank be you. Good, guys.
That is Major Garrett, Chief Washington Correspondent for CBS News. Listen to the Takeout podcast or Agent of Betrayal. You can catch them both on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. And, of course, The Big Truth, Upholding Democracy in the Age of the Big Lie. That's his book. I'm going to convert him. Major will be a Bears fan when I'm done with him.
Uh-huh.
It's Chris and Amy on KMOX.
Now, did you see this with Chris and Amy?
Ron, I don't know if you saw this, but NVIDIA, the... AI company that has just exploded. I think I just saw in less than 1 year, they went from a $1 trillion, $1 trillion valuation to over $2 trillion. Over $2 trillion. So Jensen Huang, the CEO of NVIDIA, said this week that, yep, quantum computing's great and everything, but he threw a little bit of cold water on it. He said, very useful quantum computers, his words, are probably at least 20 years away. We're not that close to very useful quantum computers. Crazy. After he said that, companies like Rigetti Computing, IonQ, and Quantum Computing all saw their share price sink for CNBC. Not not like not they're going out of business, but it did. They all dropped after he said that because I think people thought quantum computing was closer than 20 years away.
Of course. And it's a great illustration of how some of these people like him or Elon Musk, how much power they have. They could just utter some stupid sentence. And I'm not saying that what he said is stupid. He might be right. But Elon's just throwing stuff against the wall all the time. And when he does, stock prices will jump or they'll drop.
It'd be like Thomas Edison, like, I don't know about electricity.
It's kind of a stupid... I know we don't have another system, and this is what we have, but there's something about it that's... Like, maybe it shouldn't be that easy to manipulate the market for one person to say one thing to manipulate the market in the short term.
Well, yeah. I mean, I will say this. I don't think he was trying to manipulate
anything. No. I don't think... I'm just saying it's probably not good
that
one person has that much power.
And the good news is, I mean, it'll change over the next few hours. It'll change over the next few days. It's the system we have. I think it's better than anything else that's out there. But I mean, I think partly, too, it's because no one else can really contribute to this conversation with any expertise. It's just such an elite group of people who know anything about AI.
So this is a story that... It came out in 1974. Lucille Ball was on the Dick Cavett Show. But for whatever reason, back in September, this clip of her was circulating on the Cavett Show. And I just saw it yesterday. I had not seen it. But apparently she, and there's no way to fact check this, but she told a story about how she got temporary dental fillings. And she picked up a radio signal in her mouth.
So I think I've heard that. That's not just with her. It's true.
Yes. So she went to the MGM studio that day, told, I think it was Buster Keaton or somebody. I don't know who it was. And she told somebody. I don't know who the hell it was. She told somebody. And he's like, oh, that happens. She was driving down a different road and heard Morse code.
What?
This was like a week later. Was picking up a Japanese spy room that they were transmitting signals back to the Japanese army. And she picked it up and the FBI found them. That's what she says happened.
Here's the thing. Yeah. It's not unusual. It's unusual. Sorry. It's not unheard of. Apparently, this is a real thing. It happened. Yeah. She wasn't lying, most likely.
When we come back, NBC correspondent who covers crime and terrorism, Tom Winter, will join us on the Las Vegas Cybertruck explosion. And how that person used ChatGPT to pull it off. That's next on KMOX.